This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. I'm Will Bain. Great, as always, to have your company with us on the programme on what's going to be a busy programme today. Busy start of the business week again. Today, just what would a strategic national reserve, for example, mean for cryptocurrencies in the United States? And what would it mean for both crypto users around the world and taxpayers at home in the United States? We'll be trying to unpick all of that in just a moment. Also today, as inflation appears to be easing across Europe, we hear from a sector that's really felt the squeeze on what the future might look like.
The most significant has been the price of cocoa butter. It's increased 30% to 300%. I want to have a nice cocoa butter, I want to have nice chocolate, and I don't want to choose worst ingredients.
Yeah, the sounds, unfortunately not the smells, of those lovely ingredients of one Parisian bakery on business confidence, I guess, a little bit later on in the programme. And after the winner of the Best Director at the Oscars said this in his acceptance speech.
It's a communal experience you simply don't get at home. This is my battle cry. Filmmakers, keep making films for the big screen. I know I will.
Yeah, we'll check in with the boss of a major cinema chain on why Anora's multi-award winning director, Sean Baker, felt he needed to issue that rallying cry, as he put it, to the industry. Before we leave you today on World Business Report, so as I say, plenty for us to get our teeth into. We're going to kick off where, I guess, we left you with the news through the weekend and that extraordinary meeting, now ill-fated meeting, between President Zelensky on his visit to Washington with President Trump on Friday. In particular, questions about how support for Ukraine, both in military and economic terms, can be propped back up again after that seeming rift with its biggest backer, the United States. As we reported across the World Service over the weekend, European leaders gathered here in London to discuss how they could ramp up defence and financial support for Ukraine. The leaders are under growing pressure to boost defence spending after the Trump administration refused to offer US security guarantees, which are widely regarded as necessary deterrent to any future Russian aggression. The meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, as the UK's Prime Minister Keir Starmer dubbed it after the event, has sent European defence stocks surging on Monday. We'll get to those in just a moment. But also on Monday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin's spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, criticised those plans by European countries to keep giving military aid to Ukraine. And speaking to the BBC, though, the French MP, Eleanor Carrois, said this was a sign that Europe was adapting to the new situation.
They're seeing how European countries getting used to the idea that they might have to defend themselves alone. This is something that is very clear for us in France, and this is why we increased our military spending at a historical level, and we're continuing to do so. But it wasn't that obvious for other allies, and this is shifting slowly.
Yeah, shifting slowly, not what's happening with share prices, as I say, of some of those big defence firms right across Europe this morning and into the afternoon here in Europe as well. So let's get straight to it with Jane Sydenham, Investment Director at Rathbones Investment Management. Jane, of course, here throughout the programme to look at all things moving financial markets. Jane, great to have you back on the programme.
Good to be here.
That seems to be the big one today, though, and some really significant moves, perhaps unsurprising, right? Government's pledge to invest more in defence. Defence stocks go up, but by the amount they're going up, they really seem to think that these words from politicians are going to be backed by actions, I guess.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think, as you say, you know, we all watched the scenes in the White House on Friday, and I think the assumption, certainly from the markets, is that Europe cannot fail to understand its need to now spend money on defence. I mean, we've got a rise in BAE Systems of nearly 15% in a day. Similarly, Rheinmetall, which is the big German defence company, Rolls-Royce is up 5%. You know, there's some big old moves today, which certainly seem investors seem to be convinced something's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. To add to those as well, Leonardo, an Italian defence maker, up nearly 16% now, as I look to my left, and Thales as well, the big French defence firm, up more than 15% as well. Let's get a view from inside the industry. Kevin Craven's with us. Kevin's the chief executive of ADS. It's the organisation that represents a number of those firms in the aerospace and defence sector right here in the UK. Kevin, welcome to World Business Report. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure, Will. Good to speak to you.
The same question, I guess, I put to Jane then to you. Is that what do you think investors are reacting to, that you guys within the defence industry believe this is more than words, more than posturing? We heard Dmitry Peskov kind of suggesting that from the Russian point of view, that this is really going to be back with action, and by that means cash.
Absolutely. Look, I think there are two things. One is the picture of US actively withdrawing from the conflict in a way that left no room for doubt. And secondly, the longer term signals that most of the governments in Europe are making, including our own, who are talking about a commitment to 3% GDP spend on defence in the next parliament. So that long term signal is a helpful backdrop to what's happening immediately, which is a clear and present threat.
Let's flip it then the other way. Are those members, not just your members here in the United Kingdom, but I know you obviously work really closely with lots of your partners right across Europe as well, are they ready to step up to that pace, to provide at the level that this spending might require?
So, I mean, bearing in mind that the war has been ongoing for nearly 3 years now, so the defence industry has already been ramping up. And as you've seen with the deal in Northern Ireland this weekend, that would require a tripling of current production levels. And the suppliers are absolutely confident that they can deliver that.
That's Thales, so, by the way, you're talking about in Northern Ireland, aren't you? They've got a big plant in Belfast.
It is indeed. And the rest of the industry, this isn't a quick fix. It will take a little bit of time to ramp up productions to the levels required, but that's underway and we will see the industry able to deliver the requirements.
That's a really important point. Looking at some interesting analysis in front of me from the International Institute of Strategic Studies, big defence-focused think tank, talking about the kind of, in air power, they've got this extraordinary graph, Kevin. I'm sure you're au fait with the numbers as well. Basically, the scale of the US's production and facilitation of air power compared to the entire rest of NATO, not just European firms. I mean, when you're talking about ramping up, you're talking about doing something that we've never seen happen before. Surely it's going to have to happen at an extraordinary scale.
It is. And the proxy for that might be the UK's support for Ukraine. The US's support for Ukraine is approximately equal to that of Europe. So a doubling for each individual country is probably the order of magnitude that we're talking about. But that has been anticipated. And you know, to be honest, at a component level, I would be very surprised if we're not seeing elements from the US still continuing to flow to Europe as well.
Very briefly, though, Kevin, as well, I know sometimes investors in particular get uneasy around the type of companies you represent, but this could mean masses of jobs if the scale is really what we're talking about, doesn't it, as well?
Yes, it does. I mean, approximately 25% increase in defence budgets around the world, and you will see that following in the jobs. It will take time, though, because there is a shortage of the skills needed to deliver this.
Let's talk skills another time, because that's another interesting area. Kevin, really grateful for your time today. Kevin Craven there, Chief Executive of the ADS, represents the defence and aerospace industry here in the UK. Well, whilst that now infamous White House meeting that we've been talking about between President Zelensky and Trump and the potential European response stole many of the global headlines this weekend, a similarly eyebrow-raising announcement from the White House on Sunday went slightly under the radar as a result. More exactly, it appeared on President Trump's Truth Social account and stated that the US would create what it called a strategic national reserve for cryptocurrencies. In essence, we see the US government buy stockpiles of cryptocurrencies, 5 to be specific, similar in theory, its supporters argue, to holding gold reserves at, like it does at Fort Knox in Kentucky. Let's try and dig into what all this might mean. Emily Nicole is helpfully with us. Emily, an expert in all of this. She covers cryptocurrency for Bloomberg News. Emily, thanks for being with us.
Hello.
First of all, talk us through the 5 then, and then if you can as well, add to the back of that the rationale, I suppose, from the US government's point of view.
So, yeah, there'll be 5 cryptocurrencies included in the reserve. 2 of them you've probably heard of if you pay attention to crypto. That's Bitcoin and Ethereum. Those are 2 that we kind of probably would have expected to be in the mix. But then there were 3 surprises. There is Solana, Cardano, and XRP, also known as Ripple. Those are what we call altcoins, so smaller tokens that are a lot more volatile than Bitcoin or Ethereum, and they all do various different things on blockchains as well. Looking at the broader scope of what this reserve is meant to be or could be, that's still a bit of an up-in-the-air question. So part of the thinking is that, well, if the US government were to hold these tokens in a reserve, they could benefit from the rise in value. Although previously, when discussing this idea on the campaign trail, Trump promised that he would never sell any of it. So who knows whether they would benefit from the rise in value. And there's also the concept of if they would go and buy these tokens on the open market, or if they would do what was originally floated, which was to only maintain the assets that they seize from criminal proceedings. So, for example, there was a very sizable haul of Bitcoin seized a few years ago in the crackdown on the drug marketplace Silk Road. If seized assets would only make up the reserve, or if the government would go out and buy them, that's what we don't know yet.
Right. Interesting. So, yeah, it corrects a little bit what I said, which have been some of the kind of, as you say, campaign trail rumours about that the government would be doing the buying of that. That aside, that these 5 that you mentioned, as you say, I think anybody who's a regular listener to our programme will have heard of those first 2. Was there any rationale? Is there any rationale that you can perhaps see as to why the other 3 are not, you know, there are lots of other probably better known ones, aren't there, that have missed out here as well? Why the ins and why the outs? Or is there no clear pattern?
Well, so far I should say that Trump has not confirmed any of the thinking or reasoning behind, so this is all kind of industry speculation. But what traders are guessing in the market is that there's an element of those are cryptocurrencies that are particularly well known. If you look at basket indexes that get built up of cryptocurrencies to give people broad exposure, typically you'll see XRP, Solana, Cardano in the mix. So they're ones that people are generally familiar with. They have a bit of liquidity in the market. But then on top of that, we also know that some of the issuers or people behind those tokens have been playing around in Trump's circle for quite some time. A lot of the crypto industry got involved in his campaign last year, putting money behind the campaign, donating to his inauguration, XRP being one of them. Ripple Labs, which is the company behind that, said they'd spend $5 million on his inauguration. So we know that they're also kind of in his circle, and that might have contributed as well.
Yeah. To buy these things, normally, you have to do it, again, for people who are not, and I'm simplifying this massively for someone like you who's a real expert in it, but for our listeners who perhaps those who've not tried to look at buying and selling cryptocurrencies before, you buy and sell them on exchanges generally. Now, a lot of those, the biggest ones, are still banned in the United States at the moment as well. Does this suggest another shift again that perhaps some of those might get their licenses to work there back again, or might be welcomed back or encouraged to come back even?
I mean, so the world's largest crypto exchange, Binance, that is one that is still heavily restricted in the US. It's not available to US users, and they've had a lot of issues with that over the last 2 years, paying billions of dollars in fines to rectify past discrepancies in that. But there are crypto exchanges in the US that are perfectly legal there, perfectly accessible. Exchanges like Coinbase, Crypto.com, these are all names that are kind of in the space. Coinbase itself is publicly listed in the US. So I don't think it's necessary that there would be any issue in procuring the assets if the government were to be going out and buying them on the market.
An amazing shift in mood, though, isn't it?
Yes, particularly. I mean, compared to where we were, say, 2 years ago under the Biden administration, most crypto companies were saying things like, the US is super unfriendly. We can't be there without fear of enforcement from the US regulators. We're going to be hiring abroad. And now we've had a total about face. In the last month alone, we've seen the SEC, the US securities regulator, drop at least 8 cases against crypto companies, including some of those I just mentioned. And that is a real change in pace from what we saw previously, where the SEC was repeatedly going after crypto companies for perceived infractions. So it's definitely a much different environment now than it was even a year, 2 years ago.
Emily, thanks. Emily Nicole there covers crypto for Bloomberg. We're listening to that. It's Dante Disparte. Dante, Chief Strategy Officer and Head of Global Policy at Circle, a firm very much working in the crypto space amongst all other areas of digital payments. And if you're a regular listener to our Stablemate program, Business Matters, Dante, a regular panelist there as well. Great to have you on, Dante, a little bit earlier in the day with us. The rationale for all of this then, does it make sense to you?
Well, yes, and it is good to be on, and good to hear Emily's perspective, which is correct. There is a degree of consternation in the industry around the mix of assets that are being proposed for the Strategic Reserve. But the question ultimately of the United States effectively doing what the president had promised in the campaign trail, but ultimately is making a reality now that he's occupying the White House, is that the United States would be a leader in this category of technology along with AI and other areas. And so while we don't yet know the composition, the U.S. is also proposing a vehicle that can make these investments with the establishment of a U.S. sovereign wealth fund, which would arguably be, like other countries' sovereign wealth funds, a vehicle for, you know, more calculated
invest in all sorts of things, not just cryptocurrencies. Yeah, invest indeed. In traditional stocks and shares or bonds or whatever it might be, or commodities and that kind of stuff. As well.
Indeed. And this week is going to be a pretty interesting week. Not only tomorrow do we have the State of the Union address, in which these topics may feature in the president's remark. Later in the week, we have an industry CEO gathering at the White House, in which I presume a lot of these topics, and most importantly, the legislative agenda, will also come to the fore. You also have the most important piece of the puzzle here, is what to do with dollar-denominated stablecoins, the industry's current generation of a solution that's being used by millions of people around the world. And so you have a number of bills in Congress, from the Genius Act, which is a bipartisan bill in the Senate, that will look to level up the standards for competition for digital dollars, like what we do at Circle and other companies are doing as well. So there's a lot going on. And the Strategic Reserve being announced on a Sunday, it should be notable they made this announcement on a day where the banks are closed. It is a pretty telling signal of being relatively bullish for this sector.
Yeah, and we saw the prices of a lot of those coins shoot up as a result, particularly the three perhaps less well-knowns that Emily was talking about there as well. The rationale, Dante, when you have a sovereign wealth fund like that, it's using taxpayers' money, right? And the rationale for that is, if you invest in something, a company, it makes returns and the taxpayer gets returns, and it's good for the public coffers, and you can do whatever you want with that, really. You can spend it on defense spending that we've been talking about before. You can build infrastructure. You can provide healthcare, whatever it is that the government chooses to do with that. What is the crypto going to be invested in? Is it just going to be on exchanges and following what can be pretty, as Emily said, pretty wild rides on some of those exchanges?
You know, if you just look at Bitcoin on a standalone basis over the last decade, it has been the best performing single asset in the whole world. And so partly the message is the government's exposure to Bitcoin, for example, as a proxy for digital gold, is a good hedge against, be it real world, you know, market issues and volatility, and the fact that so many of these assets are uncorrelated to traditional capital market volatility is part of the argument. I think the other bigger part is what to do with seized assets is a critical question. The United States, like many other governments around the world, during, you know, law enforcement interventions, may seize certain assets here. And so in a world where these assets are surrendered or never returned to, you know, either their governments or the companies that may have them, these assets do accrue value over time. Yeah. And so there's a case to be made for parts of this. I think it's too early to say whether this is a good idea or a bad idea, in part because of the composition of cryptocurrencies that are being proposed. But over time, it is in the taxpayer's interest. You know, number one, that we make the government more efficient, and number two, that we figure out how to get long-term returns on these long investment opportunities that I think they're proposing.
All of the areas we'll keep coming back to, I'm sure, with you, particularly. I know you've worked a lot on that around US dollar denominated coins and things as well. So let's talk about that if it does indeed come up in the State of the Union this week. Great to have you on, Dante. Thanks for your time. Dante Disparte,
thank you so much.
Chief Strategy Officer and Head of Global Policy at Circle. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Now, a little earlier on Monday, there was some more positive economic news for Europe as inflation in the Eurozone, that's the 20 countries who use the euro currency, it crept down a little bit for the first time in 4 months. 2.4% for February, it was 2.5% that prices were rising in January. Jane, any big takeaways from the data for us?
I mean, it was the number was a little bit higher than most analysts were going for. They expected it to be more around 2.3%, but it is coming down. Services inflation is sort of at about 3.7%. That's come down a little bit, but it's food, alcohol, and tobacco inflation numbers were quite a bit higher. So that's really what's partly keeping that up. So, you know, we're coming into a European Central Bank meeting later this week. The balance of expectations still seems to be that we should get a cut of another 0.25% in that rate, but obviously it makes that decision a little bit harder than it was before.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's look ahead in a little more detail in just a moment. But to do that as well, we've enlisted a bit of help. We wanted to get a sector that really kind of felt the inflation squeeze in Europe in the past, couple of years in this inflation crisis. And Nina Metier, award-winning pastry chef, world pastry chef, as according to the International Union of Bakers and Confectioners in 2023, no less, runs patisserie businesses right across France. And when we spoke to her in Paris a little bit earlier on, she gave us a sense of whether those numbers today reflected what she was seeing in her business.
The inflation has an impact on our business in two main ways. The increase in the raw material prices and increase in electricity prices, of course. The most significant has been the price of cocoa butter. It's increased 30% to 300% on cocoa butter. So there is some ingredients who increase a lot. And the electricity as well, because it used to be 3% of our sales, and now it's almost 10% of our sales.
Those changes you've seen then, the funny thing about official inflation data is it's always looking backwards, isn't it? Not forwards, which you guys in a business have to do. What has it meant you've had to do with prices? Because presumably you've had to change your prices to deal with the electricity and things like butter, which obviously you use a lot of in your line of work. And what will that mean for prices going forward, do you think? Because that's obviously a key part of what happens next with inflation.
I want to have a nice cocoa butter. I want to have nice chocolate, and I don't want to choose worst ingredients, or I want to keep the quality of my ingredients. Of course, we are going to increase a little bit the price, but we need to manage as well our way to work. So sometimes we are going to put less recipes in one cake. We can use very good ingredients, but with less craftsman work. Mm. Like we can have only like for a nice start, maybe before I could put confit, mousse, supreme, a little slice of lemon. And now maybe I will not put the slice of lemon, but I will put a very nice mousse, a very nice confit crémeux, but with just the most important flavor in my cake.
Probably the most vital that I've ever done in a live interview before, because I think it was in the right place there as well, Jane. It was we thought Nina was an interesting one, because it's those businesses in it that dictate, I guess, future prices as well. Are they still feeling wage pressures? Are they still feeling pressures inside their business of those input costs, that thing like that cocoa butter that Nina was talking to us? And it doesn't seem like we've totally ridden that out yet.
No, I don't think we have. I think the wage pressures are still there. And obviously, kind of going back a little bit in terms of food, it's also weather pressures, climate change, you know, good weather, bad weather, harvests change and so on. And so there's a whole series of factors that are still keeping pressure on the inflation numbers. They we're likely to have higher inflation going forward. We've got less disinflationary forces around the world than before.
Yeah, good point, particularly around food, isn't it? We talked about things like cocoa prices, for example, lots of times on the programme. I'm sure we will again in the next few months as well. You're much of a film buff, Jane. Are you watching the Oscars closely on Sunday?
Yeah, reasonably closely, yeah.
Interesting, we thought, here on the programme, this particular rallying call that came last night from one of the big winners on the night, a winner of four awards, and in one of those four acceptance speeches, this remark caught our eye.
It's a communal experience you simply don't get at home. This is my battle cry. Filmmakers, keep making films for the big screen. I know I will.
That was Sean Baker, the director of Anora, claimed 5 awards in total, including Best Director for him and Best Actress for its star, Mikey Madison. The rallying cry to his fellow filmmakers to keep making films for the big screen, though, not just for streaming platforms, seems to beg the question, how much of an issue is that for cinemas around the world, as well as filmmakers? And Tim Richards joins us now as well. Tim, the chief executive of one of the world's leading cinema groups, View International, got more than 200 venues in 8 countries across Europe. Tim, always great to have you on the programme. Thanks for being back with us on World Business Report.
No, pleasure. Good afternoon.
Was it a necessary call from Sean Baker, do you think?
Well, no. I mean, I think any support we can get helps change the narrative of the situation that we've been in the kind of post-pandemic period. But fortunately, there is an end in sight. And I think we're going to look at the end of this year with Avatar coming out in December. We're going to look at that as really the end and the beginning and the end of the 5 years of kind of horror the industry's been through. And really the beginning of a new era in film.
What do you mean by that? What does that era look like?
Well, I mean, I think certainly if you look at the commitment that the studios have made to feature film production, every single studio learned during lockdown, during the pandemic period, when they tried to exclude cinemas, that they lost hundreds of millions of dollars. And there's a commitment now to feature filmmaking that's unprecedented. And they've been joined by Amazon and Apple as well. And Amazon loved the industry so much, they went and bought MGM Studios. And if the accounts are to be believed, if anyone has any doubt about their commitment, they've just spent $1 billion getting creative control of Bond from Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson.
Jane, the thing is, they've committed a heck of a lot to streaming too, a lot of these big companies.
Yes, I mean, you know, there's a sort of parallel universe, isn't there? So we often need cinema to kind of launch a film, but on an ongoing basis, the streamers are distributing so much content and the two really work together. I don't think they're mutually exclusive anymore.
Tim, how do you make the cinema the place then to see it in that competition, as Jane puts it?
Well, I think, I mean, certainly, I mean, no industry of any kind can ever afford to be complacent. And, you know, our focus has been in developing new seats, new recliner seats. Our new seat actually has an integrated champagne and wine cooler built into it. And it comes with cushions and a blanket. So, I mean, that's the kind of initiatives that the industry is doing globally right now to make sure that our customers have an incredible time with us.
And what about streaming, Tim? Would you show shows, do you think, in the future? Very briefly.
Well, I mean, I think, I mean, streaming is a very different business model. It's in-home versus out-of-home. But companies like Netflix, we would love to have their content because they've got some incredible content, both made for classic, made for TV movies, yeah. And
I know already you're doing a lot of the sport already in there as well. Fascinating. Can't see what the appeal is of those champagne flutes. Can anybody else? Tim, Jane, thanks so much. Thanks to you for listening to World Business Report 2.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.